This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Millie wird bei uns einziehen.
Hallo?
Basierend auf dem weltweiten Bestseller.
Soll ich Ihnen alles zeigen? Sie sollen sich hier sicher fühlen. Das tue ich.
Mit Sydney Sweeney.
Sie sind meine Rettung. Was würde ich nur ohne Sie tun?
Und Amanda Seyfried. The Housemaid, wenn sie wüsste. Ab 15. Januar im Kino.
Unsere Krankenhäuser sind immer für uns da. Tag und Nacht. In ganz Deutschland. Sie möchten mehr zur neuen Krankenhausreform wissen? Dann sind Sie hier richtig. Krankenhaus-mit-zukunft.de. Eine Information des Bundesministeriums für Gesundheit.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Hello, I'm Danny Robbins, host of the spooky podcasts Uncanny and The Battersea Poltergeist. Just before you settle down for your usual podcast, maybe you're out walking or maybe you're at home. But are you alone? Are you sure? Because this is a warning. Something wicked this way comes. My brand new podcast series, The Witch Farm, mixes documentary and drama to investigate a real-life paranormal cold case. Listen out for The Witch Farm, the true story of Britain's most haunted house.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You, me, the top experts, a big issue and 28 minutes all brought together in the virtual space that is The Briefing Room. This week, how big is the danger of nuclear weapons being used in Ukraine? The Russians are evacuating the occupied Ukrainian city of Kherson. This is one conventional war that the aggressor is not winning. So what if it doesn't stay conventional? It's certainly being talked about.
Our country has a variety of weapons of destruction, and in some areas even more modern than those in NATO countries. And if the territorial integrity of our country is threatened, we will, without question, use all the means at our disposal to protect Russia and our people. This is not a bluff.
President Putin's nuclear rhetoric is dangerous and irresponsible. We take these threats seriously. And we remain vigilant. Any use of nuclear weapons would fundamentally change the nature of the conflict and have severe consequences.
It will change the face of war unlike anything since World War II.
What would the U.S. response be?
Do you think I would tell you if I knew exactly what it would be? Of course I'm not going to tell you. It'll be consequential. They'll become more of a pariah in the world than they ever have been. And depending on the extent of what they do, it will determine what response would occur.
That was President Putin himself, followed by the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, and then President Biden on 60 Minutes on CBS News. The prospect of any use of nukes is terrifying. So what are the chances that President Putin could move from a nuclear bluff to nuclear action? And how might the Western powers respond? Step into the briefing room and we'll find out. The first and last two nuclear weapons actually used in warfare were dropped over Japan 77 years ago. After that, during the Cold War, the threat of their use was governed by a set of informal rules and doctrines. To understand those and how those rules developed after the fall of the Soviet Union, I'm joined by Sir Lawrence Freedman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London. Laurie Freeman, can we go back to what we might define as the height of the Cold War between the West and the Soviet Union in the 60s and the era of the Cuban Missile Crisis? At that stage, what were what you might call the rules of the nuclear game?
There were understandings that had developed largely through two big crises, over Berlin in 1961 and over Cuba in 1962. And then went so much rules of the game as an understanding that neither superpower really wanted a nuclear war. And the reason for that was that a nuclear war would be mutually destructive. There was no way you could start a nuclear war and hope to win. So this was the period of mutual assured destruction when the term came into use.
So in one way, at this stage, your nukes are useless to you because you both know that neither of you can afford to use them and neither of you can defend against them. How does that lead to an evolution in nuclear doctrine?
There's two things going on. On the one hand, if you actually try to think of it in terms of sort of classical military strategy, nuclear weapons seem pretty marginal because you can't use them except in retaliation. But if you think about it in terms of the emotions and passions of major crises and developing wars, then you do worry about the possibility of escalation, that even though neither side may intend to get into a nuclear war, one thing can lead to another and the situation can get completely out of control. The escalation ladder, in fact, was a concept that was developed by Hermann Kahn in the early 60s. And he imagined the 44 rungs of this ladder. And Kahn introduced this idea of sort of controlled escalation, that you would move from one step to another, and you would do so on the basis that the next step would give you what he called escalation dominance. It may not be a sure victory, but you're putting the onus on the other side to move one step more, and that would bring yet more danger. So it was the idea of something getting progressively out of control. And I think over time, the view became that any clash between the superpowers could get out of control very quickly just because everybody would get so jumpy. This was never put to the test, thank goodness, so we don't know if that would be the case. And therefore, this sense of things getting out of control was always there, and that kept people cautious.
Are there still the same sorts of rules of the nuclear game now pertaining to nuclear doctrine in Moscow and Washington?
There is still the same anxiety about all-out nuclear war. There's still the same belief that you can use that to avoid getting into clashes between the major powers. So if you're looking, for example, at Ukraine, I think deterrence is working in a rather classical way, in that NATO understands that it should not be getting directly involved in the fight with Russia, while Russia has not attacked NATO countries directly. So in that sense, it's very similar. But I think two things are different. First, there isn't the level of contact and communication between Russia and the West. Up until 2014, there was quite a lot of it, but that's diminished. So you don't get the same opportunities to check assumptions, to make sure particular moves are being understood. And secondly, we've got a situation that we didn't really think about very much during the Cold War, in which you've got a nuclear power fighting a regular war, not a guerrilla war or a colonial war, a regular war with a non-nuclear power and losing. That's what makes the current situation different from the sort of scenarios that were considered a lot during the Cold War period.
Lawrence Freedman, and we'll be returning to him at the end of the programme. Right now, I want to examine the kind of nuclear scenarios that might develop in Ukraine, most of which seem to involve what are known as tactical or battlefield nuclear weapons. Joining me now are Matthew Kroenig, professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University in Washington and analyst at the Atlantic Council, and Patricia Lewis, director of the International Security Programme at Chatham House. Matthew Kroenig, if I could start with you, how much discussion are you aware of going on in Washington about the question of a possible nuclear strike?
Well, I think this is maybe the closest the world has been to nuclear war in decades. So it's receiving a lot of high-level attention in Washington. My friends in the administration say it's one of the highest priority concerns of the Biden administration right now. And it's receiving a lot of attention in media. And there are few issues more important than the possible use of nuclear weapons in Europe.
So when something like this is discussed in Washington in the administration, who's actually talking about it?
The Pentagon is obviously focused, responsible for defense of the country. But this is such a high-level issue. You know, the Ukraine crisis, first use of nuclear weapons potentially in decades. My understanding is that high-level White House officials are thinking about it as well. And we've heard President Biden several times over the past couple of weeks reference these nuclear threats. So I think it's something that is even on the mind of the leader of the free world.
to push this on now into thinking about scenarios that might happen, first, can we just be clear on what exactly a tactical or battlefield nuclear weapon is?
There are two major types of nuclear weapons. The so-called strategic nuclear weapons are the large-yield weapons on intercontinental range delivery vehicles, on strategic bombers or long-range missiles. Battlefield nuclear weapons, also known as tactical or non-strategic nuclear weapons, are lower-yield nuclear weapons meant to be used on the battlefield. So during the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union had a lot of these things. The United States got rid of most of its tactical nuclear weapons, but Russia kept its nuclear weapons and is building more. So Russia has nuclear-armed torpedoes to go after submarines or to go after ships, depth charges to go after submarines, anti-ship missiles, mines, surface-to-air missiles to go after airplanes, nuclear-armed missile defense interceptors to go after incoming missiles, short-range missiles, bombs. Basically, any weapon system you can imagine, Russia has a nuclear variant to be used on the battlefield.
How much lower yield, Patricia, are these kinds of weapons than, say, the big weapons we saw, or indeed the only weapons that have actually ever been used, the ones at Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
They are generally lower yield, certainly than the long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles that Matthew talked about. They vary in yield. And in fact, there is a way to vary the yield according to which target you want to hit and how you want to hit it. We used to call them dialer yield weapons back in the Cold War. They tend to be somewhere between 1 kiloton equivalent of TNT up to about 15 kiloton equivalent of TNT. And 15 kiloton is about the same as Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. So we're not talking necessarily of much smaller weapons. And also the effects are not linear. A 15 kiloton bomb is not 15 times the impact. It's less than that because of the fact that it's a spherical shockwave. This means that actually the blast from a small battlefield nuclear weapon can be very large indeed, quite similar to the effects that we saw in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, depending where they're used and at what height they're detonated.
What height? Because if they're detonated very high, there will be less of an effect.
Yes, you can get a ground burst, which obviously has a particular effect. But if you're detonated at just the right height, you get this sort of reflected blast waves, which increases the effect. Both Russia and the United States know the different yields, the different heights, the different weather conditions, etc., and what they would likely see as a result of some of these blasts.
So the ways in which they would be targeted would actually depend on all those things that you've just said, just how big it was and how you intended to use it.
Yes, exactly. It would depend what you wanted to do with it. If you wanted to blast a city, then you would indeed use something quite similar to the bombs that were used in Nagasaki and Hiroshima at those heights. If you wanted to do a demonstration nuclear blast, you might do one at sea, or you might do one in a rural area, in which case you would perhaps use quite a different size. You might use a much smaller one. You might use it in a way that it doesn't create the same amount of blast, so that you would demonstrate that you had the capability and the intent, but you wouldn't necessarily want to do the sort of damage that you would do if you used a much larger one.
Now, in this era, Patricia, of satellites and Iron Dome missile defence, would it be possible for the West to intercept or stop a tactical nuclear weapon strike of this kind?
Not easy, no. With these types of weapons on the battlefield, they're not particularly accurate. They are fired by artillery, they're fired from planes, they're fired perhaps by short-range missile systems. So you could intercept with anti-missile systems, and you certainly could intercept with anti-aircraft fire, but you've still got the problem of the weapon itself and under what conditions it might detonate. While you might be able to explode it, would you be exploding something which would then create the same effect? I think this is all the sort of problems that are really worrying everybody at the moment.
Matthew Koenig, in what kind of scenario are people that you are talking to thinking that Putin might be tempted to use such a tactical nuclear weapon?
First, I would say in a way he's used nuclear weapons already. He's using the threat of nuclear weapons to deter the United States, deter the West, deter Ukraine. And it's working to some degree. The Biden administration has been carefully calibrating its support to Ukraine, trying to control escalation. If he were to actually detonate a nuclear weapon, I think the next step may be a kind of demonstration shot to conduct a test or use a single nuclear weapon, essentially to try to frighten the rest of the world to back down, maybe to cause the Ukrainians to pause, maybe to cause Western Europe or the United States to scale back its support to Ukraine. But then I think as a final step, if Putin really thinks he's about to lose in a humiliating fashion, his military is about to be overrun in Ukraine, it's about to collapse, I think as a final step, he could use nuclear weapons in larger numbers, essentially to win the war or to at least avoid a devastating defeat.
So that second scenario would be a use of these weapons on Ukrainian forces who are about to defeat Russian forces.
Yes, that's right, because these aren't just symbolic weapons. They can be used for military effect. Indeed, during the Cold War, NATO thought about using large numbers of non-strategic nuclear weapons against Soviet conventional forces, essentially to offset their conventional advantage. Now the shoe is on the other foot, and so it's Russia thinking about using non-strategic nuclear weapons against Ukrainian conventional forces. So it could be Ukrainian bases, Ukrainian supply lines, Ukrainian forces on the ground. And again, if he's willing to use them in large enough numbers, which is a big if, they could have a decisive effect on the battlefield.
Patricia Lewis.
Yes, I wondered if I could just come in on this and just say that one of the big problems we have with nuclear weapons is, of course, they do leave behind this radioactive debris, which means that it's really difficult for anyone then to move into that area and take any territory. So they're not very useful in urban environments. They're not useful in an area which you intend to later occupy. They leave a whole set of problems behind for you. So they're not like conventional forces in that way. And if he were to use them in an area which he wanted to later control, he'd have a lot of problems.
Okay. Can I just look at the various responses that there might be to those two scenarios that you've been outlining? The first scenario you outlined was essentially what a kind of demonstration with a nuclear weapon that doesn't actually do any particular harm. It's not aimed at anybody. So, Patricia, under those circumstances, what do you think the response of the West and the world would be?
If they were to use a demonstration weapon in which they really didn't harm people and had taken care to show that, I think there would be international outcry. I think at this point, probably China and India would disassociate themselves from this Russian enterprise. I don't think there would at that stage be any nuclear retaliation from the West, and I think that's been made very clear. NATO has been very careful not to escalate anything in this war.
Right. In that case, it seems gloomy of me to ask the obvious next question, really, which is to look at your second scenario that both of you have been talking about, which is the possibility of an actual use of a nuclear weapon in a battlefield situation. So, Patricia, what do you think the response to that would be?
I think, again, it depends where it is and what happens. But one concern that we have is that it might be an evacuated city that would be evacuated of Russians, but not Ukrainians. And that President Putin would use that as a demonstration to instill huge amount of fear, to essentially poke the stick at NATO and request that NATO then responds in some way. I still think that NATO would stay its hand on nuclear use, but I think at that point NATO would probably be put in a position where they would have to engage in conventional warfare.
Matthew, that would be a very big step indeed, because up until now it's been quite clear that NATO has not wanted to have a direct confrontation with Russia conventionally. If Russia were to use that nuclear weapon and the response from NATO were to be a conventional response, how substantial might that be and how effective?
Well, first, I agree with Patricia. We've already seen the Biden administration say that if Putin uses nuclear weapons, that there will be catastrophic consequences for Russia, that there will be a decisive U.S. response. So I think the United States couldn't just do nothing or couldn't respond just with sanctions. It's hard for me to imagine Biden coming out of the gate with a nuclear response. So I do think the sweet spot in the middle is some kind of conventional response. And so I think it could take a variety of forms. You know, if we were able to identify the Russian unit that launched the attack, one possibility might be to retaliate with conventional strikes directly against that unit, showing that there are serious costs for Putin using nuclear weapons, but to do it in a way that's targeted to show Putin and the world this is a proportional response to his attack. Other options that people have mentioned is maybe we could retaliate against the Russian Black Sea naval fleet, or maybe against some of the Russian forces on the ground in Ukraine, a kind of limited conventional strike.
Another option would be space operations, to use a cyber attack on space-based assets to take down all their satellite capability, or at least paralyze them. The other thing we haven't talked about is the direct threat to NATO countries.
How do you envisage that?
When President Putin has been making his nuclear threats, and I don't know, Matthew, if you agree with this, it's been us in the West that have been talking about tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine. That's not what President Putin has said. He has been talking essentially about an attack against NATO.
Matthew Kranick, what do you think?
I think it's possible. I also think that Putin realizes there is a bright red line between attacking non-NATO countries like Ukraine and Georgia and attacking a NATO country. I think he understands that if he attacks a NATO country, it could be a major war with NATO and the United States, a war that he could lose disastrously. So I have a hard time imagining him doing that right out of the gate.
Before we go completely down that path, sticking to the question about the possible use by Russia of limited battlefield nuclear weapons, both of you, the same question as I asked you with regard to the position of other countries outside the West to such a use. You mentioned China and India before, and I'm presuming that their reaction to the actual use of battlefield nuclear weapons would be even more substantial. Matthew?
Yes, well, so far, as your listeners will know, China, India, Indonesia, Brazil, other countries haven't been willing to put sanctions in place on Russia. They're kind of trying to take this neutral stance. I think if Russia used nuclear weapons, that would be much more difficult for them to do. But they still do have other interests. So China, for example, I think does benefit from having a strong Russia that can threaten the West. And so if Putin went to Xi and said, this is my only option for avoiding defeat here, I think maybe Patricia and I disagree on this. I could imagine President Xi saying to Putin, I don't love this, but go ahead. I don't want you to lose this war. And maybe, you know, Xi condemns it publicly, but it's hard for me to imagine this being a real game changer in Xi's mind, because I think he has other interests.
Patricia, do you broadly agree with that?
I think there would be a different view in China. I think China's in a very interesting transition period when it comes to nuclear weapons. And we saw this at the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference in August in New York, where China was taking a much stronger role, but it was quite a separate role from Russia. Up until now, of course, China's had a very strong pro-disarmament role. It's cast itself as a friend to the non-aligned, to developing countries. So I think it would be quite difficult for China, because, of course, this is how they present themselves to the world, but also internally. In terms of sanctions, there will be calls from within as well as from without. It will cause a lot of problems for most of the countries of the United Nations who hitherto have been sort of sitting on the fence. This will get them off the fence. And I think they will start to join sanctions, and I think they'll make things much more difficult for President Putin. Not that that in the moment be the biggest issue, right? The biggest issue at that point will be the use of nuclear weapons. And particularly, we haven't talked about this, is the actual blast, even with the demonstration blast, is where would that radioactive debris cloud go in terms of the fallout, and where would it all land?
Patricia, I want to ask you, Matthew, a last question, and it's how likely you think any of this is to happen, Patricia?
I vacillate between thinking, no, he couldn't possibly, to obviously realizing that it is a possibility. So I think we have to prepare ourselves for this. I mean, the whole point of this is to make us feel frightened, right?
Yeah.
About what Russia might do next, and for us to put pressure on our governments not to support Ukraine. And I think that's where we have to really sort of hold our nerve and not give in to nuclear blackmail.
Matthew, what do you think?
We do have some influence over this. I think as we try to deter Putin, we can affect his calculations. And I think some of the strong statements from the Biden administration in the past couple of weeks have helped and probably reduce the likelihood that he uses them. That said, I've been saying I think it's less than a 50% chance, but it's not a 0% chance. If I had to put a number on it, I'd say maybe a 20% chance.
Matthew Kranig and Patricia Lewis. Where, according to someone who's been looking at these questions for over 40 years, does that leave us? Welcome back to Lawrence Friedman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London. Laurie Friedman, the discussion we've just heard was based on the assumption of a certain rationality on the part of Vladimir Putin. Looking at the situation, how safe would you say that assumption was?
I think chances of Putin using a nuclear weapon are small because it's such a drastic thing to do and would have such consequences that he can't calculate, he can't control. He wouldn't know how it would all end. We're in an unprecedented situation, which is why I always try to be cautious about these things. But my basic assumption is that he's using nuclear weapons already and effectively for deterrent purposes. That's working for him. And if he uses them for different purposes, he jeopardizes all that. It's not wholly safe because you've got a situation where one man is making very big decisions all by himself. Other people, no doubt, are consulted and certainly would have to implement any decisions. So his emotional state, his sense of desperation is an issue. It would be almost an emotional response to a desperate situation. So that, I think, is the danger.
Right. Do you think that a possible military collapse by the Russians in the parts of Ukraine they hold could change his calculations?
Well, it's the only thing that could change his calculations. It would still be a very strange thing to do because he's not going to be able to retrieve the situation in Ukraine by doing that. It would be to coerce Ukraine to make Zelensky suddenly decide to change his mind. But change his mind to what? Because what Putin wants is for Ukraine to agree that Russia can have a whole chunk of what is now Ukraine. And the people of those parts of Ukraine aren't going to put up with it. So it doesn't really solve his problems for him. So there is an assumption of desperation in these situations, which could lead to him doing something absurd and very dangerous. But you still have to assume that Putin is calculating. And he would have to calculate a number of things if he thought that nuclear use would help him. One of them is that it could make a difference on the battlefield. Gather that's not a very easy thing to do. And that anyway, there wouldn't be a response from NATO, which probably would not be nuclear weapons, but might make his position in Ukraine even more untenable than it is by seeing Western forces taking action against Russian forces there. He doesn't know quite how NATO would react, but he's been warned that the reaction would be pretty severe.
That's interesting. So does that mean that what we should make of what President Putin has been saying about nuclear weapons since February is essentially it's a kind of classic use of nuclear weapons doctrine, which is to suggest that you might?
I think if you actually look at what Putin has said, there was a very clear statement, actually, in a press conference in Kazakhstan on the 14th of October. He was asked specifically what would happen if Ukraine was losing and NATO decided to go in and rescue Ukraine. That'd get directly involved. And then he said the world would be in great danger. Now, that was very clear. That's the deterrent effect I always thought was there, that if NATO gets directly involved, then nuclear weapons could well be used.
Now, couldn't you say that in some ways that's worked rather well because there might have been the option for the West actually of intervening directly in Ukraine at some point if it weren't for the fact that Putin possesses nuclear weapons?
Exactly. No, I think under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, which allows for the inherent right of self-defense, there was a perfectly legal mechanism whereby NATO countries, acting individually or as an alliance, could have come in support of Ukraine, but they didn't. And they were very clear from the start. And when Zelensky asked for a no-fly zone, they said, no, we don't want to get directly involved in that way. We'll give you lots of weapons, which they did. We'll give you financial assistance, but we're not going to fight ourselves. That's deterrence at work.
Sir Lawrence Friedman, and from his lips to God's ear, as they say. My thanks to Sir Lawrence and to Matthew Kranig and Patricia Lewis. The Briefing Room is going off air for a few weeks. We'll be back at the end of next month. Keep well. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Kirstine Knight, Daniel Gordon and Simon Watts. The studio managers were Neil Churchill and Graham Paddyfoot. The editor was Penny Murphy. And if you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, there are many others to listen to on BBC Sounds. You can tune in to our look at the options the British government has for public spending cuts. And there's also a programme about whether we might run out of power this winter.
Video games can be fun. Restart on BBC Sounds. They can also be a danger to your child.
We sent him to a rehab facility for teenagers addicted to video games.
What's going on?
Get off me! Stop!
A new thriller from the makers of The Cipher.
Everything and everyone you need in life is right here.
Do you want to hear a secret?
I understand there's another part of the camp. What exactly happens there?
Wait, what are the rules? I don't know what game we are playing.
What are you going to do?
Restart.
Play the game. To the end.
Available now on BBC Sounds.